KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Vladimir Putin says he will pause attacks on Ukraine's energy network, but did not sign on to a larger ceasefire proposal backed by the U.S. and Ukraine. So is a lasting peace possible? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The U.S.-backed broadcaster serving Europe, Asia, and the Middle East is fighting the Trump administration's efforts to pull funding. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We speak to its CEO, who says the cuts are a gift to America's enemies. Also, it's getting easier to get that induction stove without overhauling your wiring, and how a picture of a 19th century train crash inspired a new novel. It's Wednesday, March 19th. On this day in 1931, Nevada became the first state to legalize gambling. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli airstrikes continue today in Gaza. The Israeli military launched the surprise strikes yesterday at night. More than 400 Palestinians have been killed, more than 500 wounded. NPR's Daniel Estrin says the Israeli government is returning to war because it is trying to pressure Hamas to accept the terms of a new ceasefire deal.
The old ceasefire deal was struck under the Biden administration, and Israel sees itself as having leeway to try to extract new ceasefire terms under President Trump. That's exactly what Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, tried to do. He presented a proposal last week for new ceasefire terms for Hamas to release more hostages before the talks to end the war began.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. A federal judge has told the Justice Department to provide details about some deportation flights that happened last weekend. The judge had ordered the Trump administration not to use a rarely used wartime power to carry out the flights, but they happened anyway. Now the judge wants a timeline of when the flights occurred. Another federal judge says that billionaire Elon Musk and his government cost-cutting entity Doge likely violated the U.S. Constitution by dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Fatma Tanis has more.
More than two dozen current or recently fired employees of USAID sued Elon Musk and Doge, challenging the accelerated shutdown of the agency. In a 68-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and ordered Doge to reinstate email access to current agency employees and block them from taking any actions relating to the agency without the approval of a duly appointed USAID officer. The judge said the actions to shut down USAID and permanently close its headquarters, and that it, quote, deprived Congress of their constitutional authority over an agency created by Congress. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Historians are scouring thousands of unredacted records related to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The records were released yesterday. NPR Scott Newman reports they have yet to yield anything that would dramatically alter the official narrative.
President Trump ordered the documents released, but conspiracy theorists are likely to be disappointed with what they reveal so far. One from 1991 details a conversation between an American professor and a KGB operative. The Soviet agent concludes JFK assassin Lee Harvey Oswald was not working for the KGB. The same Soviet operative said Oswald, while living in the USSR, had a stormy relationship with his Russian wife. He also said Oswald, who had served in the U.S. Marine Corps, had shown himself to be a poor marksman. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. The National Weather Service is warning that gusty winds and dry conditions could spark wildfires today across several states, from Texas to West Virginia. Wind gusts could hit 50 miles per hour in parts of west central Texas. Living in extreme heat can age your DNA as fast as smoking does. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports on the finding from a new study published in the journal Science Advances.
Scientists and doctors have known for years that going through a heat wave can hurt and even kill people. But researchers at the University of Southern California have now identified how living through intense, long-lasting heat over the long term
could actually be taking a silent toll at the cellular or the molecular level in our body.
That's Eun-Young Choi. She's a researcher at USC and led the new research. Heat exposure in older adults is linked to changes in their DNA. Those changes lead to premature biological aging. For people living in extremely hot places like Phoenix, the aging impacts are similar to smoking. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
The Professional Tennis Players Association has filed an antitrust lawsuit in federal court. The group was co-founded by pro tennis star Novak Djokovic. The association claims the men's and the women's professional tennis tours, the International Tennis Federation, and the Sports Integrity Agency are essentially a cartel. The players are seeking a greater cut of the revenues that pro tennis brings in. They want more of a say in how the tennis organizations run their sport. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faldel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll speak with the CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is suing after the Trump administration slashed its funding.
First, Russia and Ukraine launched strikes targeting each other's infrastructure last night.
This comes hours after President Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, announced a limited ceasefire in Ukraine where Putin agreed to stop targeting Ukraine's energy facilities for 30 days. That's far short of the end to fighting on land, air, and sea that the U.S. and Ukraine agreed to last week.
With us to explain where all of this stands is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, joins us from Kyiv. So, Eleanor, a deal between Presidents Trump and Putin, what does this mean for the war in Ukraine? Will that change anything?
Well, so far nothing has changed because this is what the skies of Kyiv sounded like last night. I held my phone out our window. So you can hear the air defense shooting down drones. You know, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's been seeking a ceasefire to end attacks on people and civilian infrastructure, not just energy infrastructure. And he said on social media that these nighttime attacks by Russia are destroying the normal life of Ukrainians. He said the fact that these attacks continued right after Trump and Putin's call showed that maximum pressure must be put on Russia for the sake of peace.
What has Zelensky said about the possible ceasefire deal and Trump's conversation with Vladimir Putin?
Well, he does not trust Putin, and there seems to be a constant fear in Ukraine now of being thrown under the bus by the Trump administration, you know, being forced to make concessions, to capitulate. Zelensky had a long online press conference with journalists last night, and clearly the length of the 2.5-hour call between Presidents Trump and Putin was unnerving for him. And he was underwhelmed by the very limited agreement that came out of it, but he tried to show optimism because he has no choice, really. Let's listen.
Якщо такий перший крок, а поки що інших кроків немає,
You know, he's saying, if this is the first step and there are no other steps so far, then let's hear the details of how to proceed, and we will. And he just said he really hopes that President Trump will be able to put as much pressure on Putin as possible.
But how far apart you think Ukraine and Russia are, you know, on the terms of a possible deal?
Well, very far apart, actually. Analysts say there will have to be major concessions on both sides. And so far, the Russian demands are maximalist. For example, Putin wants land that his army doesn't even fully control in provinces that he's already annexed and is calling Russian. That's a red line for Ukraine. And Putin has said he will only accept a deal if Ukraine stops getting military assistance from his allies. Ukraine and the EU have rejected that.
So you mentioned the EU. That's the other party in this whole thing. The rest of Europe, what are they saying?
Well, yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron met with the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, and they said they will absolutely keep the military aid flowing to Ukraine. And Macron said any ceasefire must be verifiable and Ukrainians must be at the table. You know, Macron has said many times that Europe cannot let Russia win this war. Here he is speaking yesterday.
Nous continuerons de soutenir l'Ukraine face à la guerre d'agression.
He said, we will continue supporting Ukraine in this war of aggression because we know from our experience what it means to be occupied. And of course, he's talking about the Nazi occupation of France in World War II.
Yeah. You know, U.S. officials have been trying to reassure EU allies that they will be involved in any peace agreement. But the thing is, Eleanor, I mean, they haven't been. So, I mean, how do people feel about that?
Well, this is deeply shaking the continent. There's a view that Putin is stalling so he can continue the war and that he's playing with Trump, who Europeans believe is naive, has no experience with Putin, and wants a peace deal so badly he'll do anything. The former French ambassador to the U.S. went on French TV last night, Gérard Araud, and he sort of summed up the sentiment.
Il faut surtout pas énerver Trump.
He said Putin is just signing on to the peace deal not to annoy Trump, but he's testing the waters to see how far he can go. He says it's Putin's dream for Russia to be treated as a superpower dealing one-on-one with the American president over the heads of the Europeans.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is suing the United States Agency for Global Media after it pulled grants that fund the broadcaster. The Czech Republic-based news organization argues the Trump administration is not abiding by Congress's power of the purse, and it names officials, including the acting CEO of the Agency for Global Media, Carrie Lake. She says this is about cost-cutting. To discuss the suit and what's at stake here, I'm joined in studio by Steve Kappas, the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Layla.
So I want to, before we get to the lawsuit, I just want to give people a sense of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which has broadcast for 75 years. You share news in 27 languages to nearly two dozen autocratic countries with limited or no press freedoms like Russia. Now, Steve, when your funding was cut over the weekend, you called it a massive gift to America's enemies. Why a gift?
Because we're a lifeline to the people who live in those countries, and they have no access to information outside of largely government propaganda and other types of information like that. So we're leaving the information battlefield, if you will, to these countries like Iran, like China, all over our coverage area, by the way, Russia. And so at a time when there's so much happening in the world, think about what's the report we just listened to from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Think about what's going on in the Middle East. All of the U.S. international broadcasters, including Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, are threatened. VOA has gone silent.
Right. It's been replaced by music. What's the argument you're making in court?
Simply put, this was an unlawful act. USAGM does not have the ability to go around Congress. Congress has appropriated our funds. It's very clearly laid out in the budget, and we expect our funding. USAGM is simply in the position to administer a grant of congressionally appropriated funds.
Now, can you keep going without U.S. funding? As you pointed out, the Voice of America has been shuttered. There's been cuts to other private broadcasters like Radio Free Asia.
It's going to be tough. I mean, this is part of the reason why we went to court. We're living off of our savings right now, and we're in a position where we're going to have to take some pretty drastic actions in the not-too-distant future. Our audiences are already feeling the impact of the VOA shutdown, or even USAGM. They've turned off transmitters. So our audiences inside Iran, and we reach 10% of the Iranian audience on average every week, 6.5 million people. Those people have lost a significant part of their feeds, their radio feeds, because the USAGM transmitters have gone dark. That's what we're hearing from thousands of our normal audience members.
Now, you're based in Prague, and this week the Czech foreign minister asked the European Union to fill the gap in your funding. Can Europe fill the gap?
Well, we're immensely gratified that so many European nations have stepped up and said that they value this service. We've been around for 75 years. We've been in their neighborhoods, and they understand why it's necessary to stand up against Russia and China and Iran's growing malign influence all across the region, our investigative reports, things like that. They understand the value. Can they step up and fill the funding gap? We haven't gone forward to ask them that. We've been, for 75 years, we've looked to Congress to receive our funds, and we want to get this resolved. But if it comes to it, then we'll be looking at alternatives, and we have no choice. We can't let this vital institution go silent.
Well, let me ask about that. If you don't win in court, what happens to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and your journalists, including five journalists you have jailed in autocratic nations for their work?
I hate to think about it, because these people, think about it, they're being held in Russia, in Iran, in Crimea, Russian-controlled Crimea. They're being held in Azerbaijan and Belarus. Why do you think the leadership there is so threatened by our people? They're thrown into prison and because they want to silence us. This is the dedication of our people, and this is what's at risk. Those governments don't want us in there. I think whenever anybody wants to silence us, we should speak up.
Steve Kappas is the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Two NASA astronauts are back on Earth after an extended stay on the International Space Station. Their mission was set to last only 8 days, but Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams ended up spending 9 months in orbit. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne has more on the astronauts' 286 days in space.
It was a picture-perfect return as the SpaceX Dragon capsule gently splashed down under a canopy of four parachutes just off the coast of Tallahassee, Florida.
And splashdown. Crew 9 back on Earth.
But their mission wasn't as smooth as their return. NASA astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams arrived at the station back in June in Boeing's Starliner spacecraft designed to take astronauts to and from the station. It was a test flight. But during their arrival, the crew encountered problems with the spacecraft's thrusters. Starliner docked successfully, but NASA decided it wasn't safe enough to take them home. Instead, they went with another company, Elon Musk's SpaceX, for the return journey. Starliner was sent back to Earth without a crew in August, and an already planned crew mission flew to the station in September with only two of its four seats taken by NASA's Nick Hague and Russia's Alexander Gorbunov. The empty seats were for Wilmore and Williams. The four returned home together.
Nick, Alex, Butch, Sonny, on behalf of SpaceX, welcome home.
During their extended stay, Wilmore and Williams became part of the station crew, conducting 150 unique science experiments and multiple spacewalks. NASA's Steve Stitch says despite the mission not going as originally planned,
Butch and Sonny's return on Dragon to me shows how important it is to have two different crew transportation systems.
NASA says Boeing is committed to flying Starliner again, although when that will happen and whether or not it will carry a crew is still unclear. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the promise and peril of artificial intelligence. Investigative reporter Gary Rivlin's new book tells the story of how AI was developed and how big tech firms are racing to build powerful systems with enormous potential for harm and profit. His book is AI Valley. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A famous photo from 1895 is the basis for many posters and the occasional social media meme. It shows an old-fashioned steam locomotive that couldn't stop, crashed all the way through a railroad terminal, and tumbled out onto the street on the far side. The novelist Emma Donoghue saw that photo. Her earlier novels include Room, which is the story of a mother and child trapped in a room, which became a film. Now Donoghue's novel, The Paris Express, tries to imagine what life was like for travelers on that train in 1895.
An express train set off from Granville on the Normandy coast and headed straight for Paris. It was only meant to stop four times along the route, and it was meant to get in by 4 o'clock. And it all went horribly wrong, Steve. There were some important guests on the train, you know, VIPs. There were three members of parliament, and one of them asked, could the train possibly stop near his country house for his carriage to be put on? And that delayed the train by 10 minutes, which was enough to bring on disaster because the driver and stoker, the entire crew, would have felt under massive pressure to get to Paris on time despite this delay.
This would have counted, I think, as a minor train accident and not remembered to history at all, except for a particular photograph.
You're so right. In fact, it's a cluster of photographs. Lots of people rushed to the scene of the disaster and took pictures, amateurs as well as professionals. But all of them show an incongruous image of a train plunging out a window almost vertically. I don't know how I hadn't come across it in half a century, maybe because I never was in residence at a university and it's a very popular dorm room image. But basically, it's that combination of modernity and high tech and really impressive signs of industry and speed, and then complete disasters.
You said that you, until recently, were not familiar with this image as a poster and a bit of pop culture. So what got you interested in the story?
I happened to be going to live in the area of Montparnasse in Paris for a year because my partner is a French professor. That was the only place we could find a three-bedroom flat for us and our large children. I Googled it, and the first thing I saw was multiple copies of this photograph from 1895. And I just thought, that's the most arresting image I've ever seen. And I looked it up and thought, why has nobody written a novel about this?
Now, you could have made up everything except the final image, but you seem instead to have done a bunch of research. How did you go about learning about this?
You know, I find the facts are often more amazingly strange than anything I could make up. I research things really very much as if I'm doing solid history. You know, I use databases, I use newspapers. I was able to look up a wonderful hoard of bureaucracy. But then there always comes a moment when the facts run out. So I enjoy making stuff up just as much.
When you're making stuff up, I'm interested in this detail. Sometimes writers of historical fiction will say, I make stuff up that is consistent with the historical record, that could have happened even if nobody knows that it did. Do you try that?
Yes. For instance, I didn't have an individual coffee seller person to use on my train, but I spotted in a photograph in the Paris Historical Museum, I spotted an amazing image of somebody wearing a gigantic tank on their back, full of hot coffee, which he served out of little taps on his chest. And I thought, okay, that is clearly credible for the time to have a human coffee pot serving the busy commuters. And what a modern image.
When you began learning about some of the passengers on the train, what are some of the kinds of people you found?
We all know that on a train, there's going to be a vivid example of the class system because people are literally segregated into nice red velvet covered carriages in first class and then horrible cramped carriages in third class. But I also found diversity in other ways because France was the center of its own empire, right? So you've got Cambodian students, you've North African coffee sellers, you've expats, American painters visiting like Henry Ossawa Tanner. You have troublemakers and anarchists and lowlifes visiting Paris. You have inventors, you have writers, you have queers, you have feminists.
Well, let's remember what railroads were doing in the 1800s when they were the hot new technology. How were they changing society?
Well, for instance, on my train, the local makers of Camembert, they were able to ship their cheeses across the world before the cheeses got too stinky. So suddenly, your man and woman in a village in Normandy could ship their cheeses to New York, and that meant they could actually stay in their village and they could make money there. So it had a huge influence on the settlement patterns, emigration patterns. Trains were astonishingly central to the shaping of Europe. It was the perfect vehicle for a novel because a train moves from beginning to end with unexpected events along the way, just like a novel.
And I think you're right that it's transforming commerce, but also communication, but also society and where people live and how people work and essentially everything.
Oh, and time, for instance. Suddenly you had to have standardized time zones because the trains were the first things that could, you know, whiz from one state in America to another fast enough that they might actually collide with each other if they weren't working on the same time. So suddenly people had to start standardizing their watches.
Did the experience of writing this book change the way that you thought about the next time you were checking email or doing something online or whatever you were doing in modern times?
You know, writing this book didn't turn me into a Luddite, but it certainly helped me think in a very practical way about the costs of our technology and our longing to get there faster and easier and smoother. The ideal of the frictionless life, it's always based on somebody else's hard labor.
If it didn't turn you into a Luddite, what did it do? Just make you try to appreciate all the unseen parts of our lives?
Yes, and be aware that you can make decisions. I mean, you know, one of the reasons the train crashed is, I would say, the big railway companies, they had an implicit policy of, yeah, go ahead and speed. You know, in theory, the drivers weren't meant to speed, but the company was like, we'll give you all a good big bonus if you get to Paris on time, despite delays, you know, and any delays caused by the passengers. Can you make up that time, please? It also made me think a lot about my own mortality, actually, because the train, again, starts to seem like an image of a human life. You know, you think you have all the way till Paris, but there can be an interruption and a derailment at any moment.
I am thinking of the popular internet phrase, move fast and break things, which has been repeated a lot recently because of Elon Musk's actions in Washington. This train was moving fast and breaking things. And you note the historical fact that the crew was in no way particularly punished for the crash.
No. These were just seen as the costs of doing business, to use another cliche.
Emma Donoghue is the author of The Paris Express, her latest novel. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure has been all mine, Steve. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
In 2022, the Chinese government told NPR's Emily Fang she was no longer welcome in China, where she had lived and reported for 7 years. Even so, she says she hasn't lost claim to her Chinese identity.
Being Chinese is not confined to the boundaries of the People's Republic of China.
I'm Elsa Chang. My conversation with NPR's Emily Fang on her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A federal judge says the Trump administration and Elon Musk likely violated the Constitution when they effectively shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development. Here's NPR's Fatma Tanis.
Judge Theodore Chuang wrote a 68-page opinion detailing why. He said that the evidence showed that, quote, Musk made the decisions to shut down USAID's headquarters and website, even though he lacked the authority to make that decision. He said that Musk and Doge team members likely violated the Constitution in multiple ways and deprived Congress of its authority to decide what to do with an agency that it created.
The Trump administration is appealing. A separate federal judge is blocking President Trump's executive order that bans transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. As with the USAID ruling, the judge describes this order as likely unconstitutional. The Pentagon estimates more than 4,200 active duty service members have been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he has questions for President Trump about Trump's two-hour phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday. Zelensky says he'll be speaking with Trump about it today. Putin told Trump he would agree to halt attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. This is NPR News. One of Turkey's main presidential contenders is under arrest on charges of corruption and aiding terrorism. As NPR's Jane Araf reports, the opposition says his arrest is politically motivated.
The mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, is from a leading opposition party and has been expected to run against Turkey's prime minister if early elections are called. Today, security forces arrested him before dawn, while prosecutors issued arrest warrants for 100 other people, including an aide to the mayor and a leading journalist. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is believed to be considering calling elections before his term ends in 3 years in an effort to avoid term limits. İmamoğlu is considered his main political rival. His party, the CHP, called the arrests a coup, an attempt to subvert democracy. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
The state of Louisiana has executed a convicted killer using nitrogen gas. It was the state's first execution in 15 years and the first time using nitrogen gas. Only Alabama had used that method of execution previously. Later today, the state of Arizona is scheduled to execute a death row inmate for the first time in 3 years. It follows a review of the state's death penalty protocol ordered by the governor. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. A movie theater in Miami Beach is facing eviction from a city-owned building after it showed the documentary that won this year's Academy Award. No Other Land follows the displacement of a Palestinian community in the West Bank. But Miami Beach's mayor said the screenings have to stop. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
No other land stirred controversy even before it took home the Oscar for Best Documentary. Israel's Minister of Culture and Sports called it a carefully crafted piece of demagoguery. A collaboration between Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers, it follows events in a Palestinian town in the West Bank as soldiers and bulldozers tear homes down so it can be used as a military training zone.
This is what's happening in my village now. Soldiers are everywhere.
That's from the trailer. The film has struggled to find a distributor in the U.S., but is being screened at a handful of independent theaters around the country, including O Cinema in Miami Beach. That news surprised Miami Beach's mayor, Stephen Miner. In a letter to the theater's CEO earlier this month, he cited some of the criticism leveled at the film and asked her to, quote, not air this hateful propaganda film. In a video address to constituents yesterday, Miner said he watched the documentary before sending the letter.
It definitely triggers emotions, the movie. Certainly painting the Israeli army and the Jewish people in general in a very negative light. Definitely a one-sided propaganda.
Miner says many important facts about the history and ownership of the land in the town was left out of the film, and that it shouldn't be shown in a city-owned building. After receiving his letter, O Cinema's CEO, Vivian Martel, at first told the mayor she would pull the film because of concerns it might be viewed as anti-Semitic. But by the next day, she saw what she calls the broader perspective.
That it wasn't about the film, it was about our First Amendment right. I had a conversation with my staff, with my board, and we all agreed that it was really important to show this critical film. It's an award-winning film. It's on mission.
No other land has been sold out at screenings, and O Cinema has added additional dates. But in the meantime, Mayor Miner drew up a proposal to cancel the theater's lease at a city-owned building. He would also withdraw some $40,000 in city funding. Miami bookstore owner and film producer Mitch Kaplan says Miner's proposal violates principles of free speech and artistic expression that are an important part of American democracy.
Threatening to evict a theater for showing a film is clearly an act of censorship, plain and simple.
In his video address yesterday, Miner, who's Jewish, noted that Miami Beach has a large number of Jewish residents. The documentary, he says, is anti-Semitic.
Free speech is sacrosanct, but hate speech, not so much, especially when it has the ability to cause significant damage.
Daniel Tilley, an attorney with ACLU Florida, says under the Constitution, all speech is protected, even if an official disagrees with it. He says the law is clear.
The First Amendment does not allow the government to discriminate based on viewpoint or to retaliate against anyone for their speech. This is not a gray area. Simply put, if the city of Miami Beach adopts this resolution, they will be breaking the law.
The dispute surrounding the showing of No Other Land in Miami Beach has galvanized support for O Cinema from around the country. More than 600 filmmakers have signed a letter urging Miami Beach City Commissioners to reject the proposal to evict and defund the theater. The commission is scheduled to vote on the mayor's proposal at a meeting later today. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami Beach.
About a third of the country's climate pollution comes from buildings. Now, one way to reduce that is to switch from fossil fuel burning appliances to electric ones. Thing is, that can require expensive electrical upgrades, but manufacturers are working to make it easier. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
In a Manhattan apartment, Max Van Gilder is making spaghetti carbonara.
Mix the eggs and garlic together.
On his new stove, there's pork sizzling in a frying pan. Van Gilder is a retired pediatrician and wanted to replace his old gas stove with a new electric one.
As I'm getting older, I was afraid that I would leave the gas on.
And to save energy, he wanted an induction stove that heats pans with magnetism rather than flames. But switching required expensive electrical work. Then he found a company called Copper. It makes induction stoves that plug into a regular outlet. A battery under the oven charges through the night and powers the stove, eliminating the big plug most electric ranges have. Van Gilder likes his new stove, but it came with a hefty price.
The base price is $6,000. There's a tax credit that brings it down to about $4,000.
Copper CEO Sam Kalish says that's still a bargain for older multifamily buildings with gas pipes that sometimes leak climate warming methane.
In these cases, we install for less than half of what it costs just to fix the gas system, and then we allow that building to retire that old aging infrastructure and decarbonize it.
Beyond stoves, companies are making heaters and air conditioners that plug into a standard outlet. Joe Soto is testing one in his Woodside, New York apartment.
I call ourselves the guinea pigs.
The New York City Housing Authority used to heat Soto's home with steam radiators.
No, it wasn't very reliable. There are times that we spent many winters freezing in the cold.
Now his two-bedroom apartment has three window heat pumps that save energy by extracting heat in one place and moving it to where it's wanted, similar to how a refrigerator works. These heat pumps are mounted like a window air conditioner, and Soto says they also cool his apartment in the summer.
The temperature's been constant. Winter and the summer, you don't feel the difference.
One company making these window heat pumps is Gradient, where Vince Romanin is the founder and chief technology officer.
We can install our system without any building modification, without any electricians, without holes in the wall, without asbestos mitigation, without scaffolding. All of these things. It is 30-minute install, so we're in and out of the resident's home.
Heat pump technology is used in water heaters, too, and there's a plug-in version designed to replace a gas water heater.
It was all done in one day. It wasn't a major overhaul.
Laura Nakamura in Concord, California, got one last year and says it's louder than her old gas one because there's a fan, but it also blows cold air, which should cool down her garage in the summer. And it works as well as her gas water heater did.
It's just as hot and the water is still just as wet.
She jokes, but plug-in heat pump water heaters do take longer to warm up. James Courtney is with the water heater manufacturer Rheem.
Because of the slower recovery, we do often recommend that those are installed in warmer states. Really, the main thing is the incoming groundwater temperature.
Warmer water requires less energy to make it hot. Rheem says water heaters like this are still a small portion of the overall market, but the fastest growing. And Panama Bartholomew with the Building Decarbonization Coalition says more products like this are coming.
I know there are manufacturers that are looking about putting batteries inside heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems.
He says those will plug into a regular outlet too, and with a battery, they'll continue working when the power goes out. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast by the Boston Globe's investigative team Spotlight examines the role confidential informants play in police work and the misconduct in that system. Next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. It's an aquatic glow-up, the blobfish. Well, looks like it sounds. It's sort of a blobby tadpole. Government scientists call it a mass of pale, jelly-like flesh with puffy, loose skin. It was called the world's ugliest animal back in 2013. Rough. But now the blobfish is getting its due. It's been voted New Zealand's Fish of the Year. Conservationists behind the vote say it has an unconventional beauty. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. With the Trump administration trying to lay off tens of thousands of federal workers, some Democratic governors are sensing an opportunity. WESA's Tom Reese reports they want fired federal workers to apply for state positions.
At a recent job fair in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order directing state agencies to consider federal experience on par with state experience. It's a move that he hopes will fill nearly 6,000 open positions with the state for registered nurses, civil engineers, and accountants.
If they're qualified and they want to serve Pennsylvanians, well, hear me on this. We want you on our team.
Like Shapiro, Hawaii Governor Josh Green.
I'm fighting to make sure people who lose their jobs can get a job through Operation Hire Hawaii.
And New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
Come join our New York State family.
Have announced campaigns to appeal to federal workers who are new to the job hunt after sweeping government layoffs. Pennsylvania is home to more than 100,000 federal employees, and it's unclear exactly how many lost their jobs since Donald Trump took office. But in its first week tracking former federal applicants, the Pennsylvania office in charge of hiring says at least 700 people disclosed they used to work for a federal agency, and they've applied to over 1,000 positions. But not all federal employees say they're ready or even willing to go back to government agencies.
Oh, geez, I have to figure out what to do next.
Megan Schwob, a former U.S. Forest Service worker, was laid off in February in Oregon. After what she says has been nearly a month of uncertainty, she moved back across the country and home to Minnesota. She'll soon start a job in the private sector, despite calling the Forest Service her dream job.
I think damage has kind of been done for a lot of people who, it's been a couple weeks now, where people have really had to find new jobs and start new lives.
She says in her case, there might not be a job at the state level that matches what she did to maintain national forests.
There's just not as much correlation from the couple million acre public land to a smaller state-run park or facility.
Salaries likely differ too, says Philip Glover, who heads the union, the American Federation of Government Employees, in Pennsylvania and Delaware.
Usually the state is a little lower starting salary. It depends on the job, obviously.
But Republicans in Pennsylvania have expressed concern about hiring federal workers fired for poor performance. That's what many of their termination letters say. Republican State House Leader Jesse Topper says it comes down to efficiency.
Sometimes that doesn't take more people. Sometimes that takes less. But whoever we have in those jobs certainly need to be competent and doing their jobs efficiently.
Glover, with the union, says actually working for the federal government is a pre-qualification for working for the state.
Clearly, these were political terminations. These weren't for cause.
More than 500 employees in his local union have filed for unemployment. And he says many are waiting to see what effect judges' rulings have on reinstating some agency workers. As far as Pennsylvania, Glover says,
I think the governor stepped out there and did some things that some of the other states aren't doing, and we appreciate his willingness to do that.
The AFGE and other federal unions will monitor judges' rulings on whether workers can have their jobs back, and states will keep trying to entice feds to work for them instead. For NPR News, I'm Tom Reese in Harrisburg.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal jury in San Antonio says two men are guilty for their roles in the deaths of 53 migrants, including six children. It was the deadliest human smuggling incident in modern U.S. history. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flab reports on Tuesday's verdict.
Felipe Orduña Torres and Armando Gonzalez Ortega faced the rest of their life in prison for the deaths that took place in the back of a tractor trailer without air conditioning in the South Texas sun. The men were both found guilty of all charges ranging from smuggling the people into the country to the overarching conspiracy that resulted in the migrants' injuries or deaths. Migrants dying while being smuggled into the country have been found many times throughout the past decade, but this was especially egregious, says San Antonio immigration attorney Jonathan Ryan.
It remains the largest single casualty event of its type in Texas and potentially in the United States. That is in terms of those who have been discovered.
The men are part of an international smuggling operation, federal prosecutors say. Five others have already been convicted or pleaded guilty, also facing potential life sentences. The case showed a vast network of human smuggling crossing multiple countries that have spurred other investigations and international indictments. After the verdict, federal prosecutor Eric Fuchs showed images from inside the sealed tractor trailer to reporters showing claw marks.
Claw marks from when they were desperately clawing at the sides, trying to get out. You could see that insulation, the scraps of it, and how it's fresh right below the claw marks.
The people who died came from Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. The tractor trailer in which they were found came from Laredo, Texas. 11 people survived the devastating trip and are still in the United States with the opportunity to apply for U visas, which are given to non-citizens who are victims of some crimes. Orduña Torres and Gonzalez Ortega will be sentenced June 27th. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
The 65,000 delivery workers in New York City, deliveristas, became essential workers in the early days of the pandemic. WNYC's Arun Venugopal looks back 5 years later.
The other day, Gustavo Akje sat outside the New York Stock Exchange. Tourists from around the world were milling about, taking pictures in front of the statue known as Fearless Girl.
This is my area.
Akje is the founder of Los Deliveristas Unidos. The group represents workers who deliver the meals that New Yorkers order via DoorDash and other apps. He says just thinking about Manhattan 5 years ago when the city streets were desolate makes him sad.
Because most of the time during the pandemic, like at 3 or 4 p.m., this street was so quiet, you're not seeing nobody.
No one except for delivery workers. The vast majority are immigrants, and they kept bringing New Yorkers their meals and medications on e-bikes and mopeds. It wasn't easy. The streets were eerily quiet, and delivery workers were vulnerable to assault and robbery. So they formed WhatsApp groups to stay in touch with each other.
They say, hey, you okay? Yes, I just dropped the food on my way back. Okay, you're safe.
But Akje felt the rest of the city was hardly giving the workers much thought. If you lived through the pandemic in New York, you might have leaned out your window every evening and banged a pan for essential workers. This was Harlem in April of 2020.
Every time New Yorkers will come out of the doors to clap, they will mention every worker who was in the front line except deliveristas.
Ligia Guapa runs the Workers Justice Project and joined forces with Akje early in the pandemic. They fought to improve pay and safety for delivery workers and help New Yorkers understand this is essential work. Hualpa's voice cracked as she told the story of one worker who delivered a case of water through heavy rain. The ride took 30 minutes and paid $4. No tip. By the time he arrived, Hualpa says he was exhausted and furious.
And when somebody opened the door, it was an old lady on a wheelchair. And he said, at that moment, I cried because I was like, I'm helping somebody that cannot get access to basic services. And he said, at that moment, I understood what my role was.
The efforts to initiate change began to pay off. In 2021, the workers secured a raft of city laws improving their pay and working conditions. And last month, DoorDash agreed to pay nearly $17 million to settle claims that it withheld tips meant for thousands of delivery workers. A DoorDash spokesperson said the settlement was related to an old pay model that's since been retired. But Hualpa says the results have been validating.
It's a beautiful story that explains the power that a small grassroots organizing group has built in the city of New York.
Gustavo Akje says he's proud of what's been achieved since the pandemic and that delivery workers are not done fighting. For NPR News, I'm Arun Venugopal in New York.
Music fans from around the world are remembering Honduran folk musician Aurelio Martinez. He died this week in a plane crash near the Honduran island of Roatan. 11 others also died.
That's so beautiful. Martinez grew up in a remote area of northern Honduras. He moved to the port city of La Ceiba at the age of 14 to study music and eventually launched his performing career alongside Belizean musician Andy Palacio.
Martinez was called an ambassador of Garifuna music. It's a blend of reggae, Latin, and calypso. Here he is at his NPR Tiny Desk concert in 2015 explaining the cultures and influences that make up Garifuna music.
Garifuna music is a special music. This culture comes from a special mix with African people and Arawak Indian in the Caribbean island in St. Vincent. From this mix come from a new culture, Garifuna culture, Garifuna community. Welcome to Garifuna Nation.
In 2005, Martinez took a break from performing to become the first Afro-Honduran elected to the country's National Congress, but he left politics after a few short years to return to his true love, making music. That included international tours, Garifuna songwriting workshops for kids, and three more studio albums.
Last year, one of those releases, Landini, was named one of the best Latin American albums of all time by music journalists from the region. Aurelio Martinez was 55 years old. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.